CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 81 with Dr. John Berdahl. Rethinking the cause of glaucoma with a physics mindset. Does intracranial pressure affect glaucoma? Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. Today, I have a very special guest, my friend, Dr. John Berdahl. You've seen his name everywhere. He's done so much to help cataract refractive glaucoma surgery. And I got a million questions to ask you. John, welcome to our podcast.
Excited to be here, man. Hi from South Dakota.
Yeah, I actually did a little research on you. So you're right near home.
Yeah.
You went to high school like 30 minutes away across the border of Minnesota. Then you hopped over to Sioux Falls for college and you're back home.
Yeah, well, and it's even deeper than that. My family settled out here 150 years ago and was the largest wagon train to enter the Dakota Territory. So I don't see opportunity very well. So I just, we're still here.
Wow, that's really neat, though. I mean, I'm the same way. My clinic is like 10 kilometers from my high school.
Yeah. And then I went back and I taught high school for a year in Hills, the Hills, Minnesota, where I graduated from with 34 kids. And I had to do something easier than be a high school math teacher, so I became an eye surgeon.
That's awesome. Yeah, I saw you were head of the math department.
Only one math teacher in the department, so I had to be the head of the department.
That's the easy way. You know, obviously, majoring in physics, though, kind of explains a lot, because your way of thinking of things, you're very much like engineering mindset. You're very much a problem solver.
That's for sure true. I was going to go to college, was a physics major, was going to be an engineer, decided I wanted to work with people more. But I'm not a very good pharmacologic thinker, but I do feel like I can think through the physics and the physical problems pretty decently. So that is the way I approach problems.
Right. When I saw many years ago, your astigmatismfix.com website. So that's a website where if you have a malrotated toric lens, it'll tell you, hey, how do you have to rotate it back and what's the end result going to be? But clearly it's all math.
Yeah. Yeah. Just trigonometry. And so there's a big wonky spreadsheet that we created. That's the engine behind it. And Dave Harden, my fellowship director, came to me and said, hey, you taught math. I've got this patient that has a toric lens that's malrotated, but it doesn't quite make sense to me. Figure out where we should rotate it. So I created this spreadsheet, and then I got sick of people emailing me for it. So we made it free on the web, and it's helped a lot of people.
Yeah, even I've used it. I think it was awesome. It just simplifies it, makes it so easy.
Yeah, good.
Now, you say you didn't do much with pharmacology, but you also helped develop MKO-MELT.
Yeah, we did. And so that's fun. So MKO-MELT is midazolam, Versed, and ketamine. And it happens, the O is on dancitron, but in the FDA approved version, if we're lucky enough to get the FDA approved version, which is in phase 3 trials now, then it'll be underneath the tongue and it'll dissolve in about 5 seconds as opposed to the 5 minutes now. And it combines the ketamine and the Versed. And the thought process there was that they would be synergistic, that perhaps we'd get some pain benefit from the ketamine, get a little bit of euphoria, get some stare. When we did our phase 2 trial, which was a big complex study that was designed for FDA, it had 4 arms, midazolam and ketamine and placebo. We found that the midazolam and ketamine arm was about twice as good at avoiding rescue sedation than midazolam or ketamine alone. I think that it was something like 80% didn't need rescue, and there are kind of strict criteria about that. So we're hoping that that's replicated in the phase 3 study, and we've got an FDA approved non-opioid way to not have to start an IV yet sedate our cataract patients and other minor surgical procedures maybe down the road.
Yeah, I don't think it's a great idea. So you get away with the whole no need for an IV, and then I get no need for using opioids like fentanyl during the procedure.
Yeah, so let me ask you this. Guess what percentage of cataract surgery has fentanyl in it across the country that has fentanyl as part of the sedation?
80.
50.
50, all right. Wow.
So 50% of cataract surgeries have fentanyl. 5 million cataract surgeries a year or so. Probably about 2 to 2.5 million unnecessary doses of fentanyl going into the system.
Yeah, I mean, albeit small doses, right? 25, maybe 50 micrograms typically.
Small doses, but when you start looking into the literature on it, yeah, they matter. they matter to how people do afterwards. And actually, AAO and a number of papers have been in ophthalmology about it too.
Wow. Also interesting that you said, the ketamine helps give them a little bit of a stare. It's like stare at your light.
Yeah. That's right. You know, we're not trying to create druids that are staring at the sun, but they have a tendency to squinch less.
So like kind of deer in the headlights. That's really, but you got rid of the O, the no odansetron.
No O. There's two major reasons why that's out of the FDA formulation. Number one, and you probably know this already, but when you're doing drugs, you have to show contribution of elements. That's why there's so few combination medications out there that are FDA approved. You got Combigan, Cosopt, but you don't have anything combined with a prostaglandin. And that's because they don't show additional effect enough to get an approval for it. So then if you've got three drugs in one, now you have to show that each one independently is either synergistic or is effective against the secondary endpoint. And so that's the biggest one. And then ondansetron has, in high doses, can lengthen the QT interval. In short doses, it doesn't. But then you really have to prove that for ondansetron in a study. So we went with just the M and the K. And if somebody needs a little Zofran at the end of the case, give them some Zofran.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense there. But no, I think it'll be helpful for the patients to be able to do this, give them that light sedation, and then get your procedures done.
Well, let me tell you a story just real quick on this. There's a television show called Bling Empire.
Okay.
I had never heard of it. Okay. But they use the MKO Melt on this show. It's based in Southern California, and it was the number two show on Netflix for a while, and this gentleman was that? They were using it for a cosmetic procedure. They were doing threading, I think it's called, where they take and put a needle like through your nose with some thread on it, and it increases collagen and decreases your pores. I don't know anything about that kind of stuff, but it was on Netflix. They just pulled it out of the wrapper.
Wow, that's pretty wild. I had no idea. Yeah, I don't know much about the cosmetic world, even though I am in Beverly Hills.
And you're that good looking. So that's all natural, Uday?
Sadly, I've hit the wall. What are you talking about, man? Although I'll probably catch up with the beard with you.
Yeah. Now,
tell me, so that we covered that, MKO Melt. Tell me about, you have other projects too. You have a glaucoma company. Equinox. Yeah. What is that all about?
Yeah. So this one will take a little bit. So give me 3 minutes, maybe four. So I was a first year resident at Duke, and we went on our one vacation and we went scuba diving. And I was thinking while I was scuba diving, instead of enjoying my dive, how's it possible that you can go down just 30 feet? Because that adds 760 millimeters of mercury of pressure to your eyeball.
Okay.
How can the eye tolerate that? And I thought that it must be that it's not the absolute pressure inside the eye that really matters. It's what's behind the eye, the cerebral spinal fluid that bathes the optic nerve all the way to the back of the eye. And I came to believe that glaucoma is a two pressure disease, not a one pressure disease, either a high eye pressure or a low intracranial pressure that causes a pressure differential across the lamina cribrosa, and it bows back and it slows axonal transport. It explains why normal tension glaucoma exists. You can have a normal eye pressure, but if you have a low CSF pressure, that pressure differential still exists. It also explains ocular hypertension, high eye pressure, no glaucoma, high CSF pressure that's protective. So I went to Mayo Clinic where I did my med school. We looked at 50,000 lumbar punctures over the last 20 years, found patients that had glaucoma, found controls, and found that indeed, patients that have glaucoma have a low CSF pressure, and patients that have normal tension glaucoma have an even lower CSF pressure.
Oh, interesting.
Okay. So now you say it's a two pressure disease. These two pressures across the lamina cribrosa, and it explains these things. Now, there have been studies that were done on monkeys after we published this paper in 2008, and they took monkeys and they lowered their CSF pressure and they found that they got glaucoma. even though they had normal eye pressure.
Oh, that's so wild.
So now I'm going to fellowship with Dick Lindstrom, Tom Samuelson, Liz Davis, Dave Harden, the guys in Minnesota Eye Consultants. And so I'm going to present this theory to Dick, you know, the king.
Right.
And I sit down with him and I'm nervous and I explain it to him. And he says in his deep voice, John, I think you're right. What are you going to do about it? And I'm kind of like, what do you mean? What am I going to do about it? People are going to think I'm smart. That's it. And he said, well, I'd really like to see if you can use this knowledge to actually help people, maybe even start a company around it. I said, I don't have a good idea. He said, opportunity favors the prepared mind. Fast forward a few years, there's an issue with astronauts in space. About 50% of astronauts on long-term space flight are losing their vision.
Whoa, and, I didn't know.
Yeah. So if you're up there for 6 months, about 50% have this condition called SANS, which is space-associated neuro-optic syndrome. And basically, it's papilledema. Optic nerve is bowing forward. There's some choroidal folds. There's a hyperopic shift, and that's the syndrome. And I said, I think I know what's going on. It's the opposite of glaucoma. So in space or on Earth, if glaucoma is a high eye pressure or low CSF pressure, in space where there's no gravity, the opposite happens. And so the fluids shift up towards your head. And now your CSF pressure at eye level is higher than your IOP. And now you get swelling of your optic nerve because your CSF is higher and everything bows forward. And it looks kind of like hypotony maculopathy or IIH. So I reach out to NASA, get an invite to be part of the Vision for Mars team. Super cool, right? My kids think I'm cool. I meet some astronauts. It's amazing. And we get a little grant money. And I'm ping-ponging ideas with Vance, my partner. And we ultimately, and I'm thinking, okay, if I can raise eye pressure to match the CSF pressure, we can protect the optic nerve and protect vision. So raising eye pressure, right? Sounds scary, but just 5-10 millimeters of mercury to balance it. How could we do that? We could do that with a pair of goggles that we pressurized and pushed on the eye.
Sure.
And so then I thought, well, why can't we do the opposite? Where you put in negative pressure because we've got all this atmospheric weight pushing down on our body.
Right.
Pressurizing our whole body. So we're just going to depressurize the eye a little bit and see if we can lower IOP. So we did that. And we did that study, and through lots and lots and lots of bumps in the road and a failed company, ultimately in March, we went to FDA panel, which is essentially the highest level of scrutiny that there is for the FDA. We won 13-0, and we got our FDA approval at the end of June.
Wow. And
so basically, it's a pair of goggles that we can dial in up to 20 millimeters of vacuum. Think about it that you'll get about half of what you dial in IOP lowering, maybe a little more. So if you dial in minus 20, you'll get about minus 12 of effect. We've got well over 1,800 different measurements in our studies. Everyone, 100%, showed that we lowered IOP. Everyone. And at night, we did this as a sleep study, so people were getting their pressures measured at night, three times a night. At night, 97% of these patients had greater than 20% IOP lowering on top of their medications, on top of their prior surgery. And these were all normal tension glaucoma patients, which are hard to treat. And so we took patients down to a pressure of somewhere around 12, 12.4, 11.8, something like that at night on top of their medications. Now it only works while it's on, and it's indicated for patients whose eye pressure is less than 21. So it's really an attempt to treat these hard to treat normal tension glaucoma patients. We just successfully completed a funding round yesterday. So you're the first person to also heard it here first. And so we're working now on getting reimbursement in place with Medicare, and that'll take us about 18 months. And now I think we'll be able to launch commercially, but we've got the first FDA approved way to lower eye pressure without drugs and without surgery. And so we think that that'll be helpful to patients. So that's the story from all the way to the beginning to where we are now, and I left out a lot of the gruesome detail.
So these are, you basically, the patient is going to wear these goggles then, essentially full time?
No, they'll sleep in them.
Just sleep in them.
Yeah. So at
how long is the effect after they take the goggles off?
Only when you're wearing them. So it's kind of like this. If I push on your eyeball, your eye pressure has to go up. When I stop pushing, your eye pressure has to go down. So it only works while it's on. And what we know is that eye pressure goes up at night while people sleep, especially people that have normal tension glaucoma. And that's a vulnerable time where blood pressure goes down as well. And that's been associated with progression of glaucoma. And so we think that we're treating the nighttime eye pressure that oftentimes is elevated that is causing advancing of the disease in these normal tension glaucoma patients.
So that begs the question, should we be doing a lumbar puncture and checking opening pressure of the CSF?
I have on a couple of patients, but I don't know that it necessarily changes the management because we don't have a way to manipulate the CSF itself. But we do know that if they're getting worse, we need to get the eye pressure lower. So on
patients who have like a VP shunt,
they get worse.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And then the other thing is that every once in a while, if you're astute and you see a normal tension glaucoma patient, ask them if their nose is running, because every once in a while, you'll pick up somebody that has a CSF rhinorrhea that has normal tension glaucoma because they had either a spontaneous CSF leak there or they had some trauma in the past.
No.
Really uncommon, but you feel a little bit like a hero when you pick that up. And now I know this is cataract coach, but this is a fun question I like to ask, especially when we're around people that are glaucoma nerds. And I, you know, I'm a cataract nerd. I'm a glaucoma nerd. I'm a cornea nerd. I'm a refractive nerd. You don't get nerdier than me. But I'm going to just put you on the spot if that's okay.
Of course, let's go.
What happens to IOP with age? We know glaucoma increases with age. What happens to IOP with age? Go up, stay the same, go down.
Well, I bet you CSF pressure goes down.
You skip right to the head of the class. So eye pressure stays the same, maybe goes down a little bit.
Yeah.
Incidence of glaucoma goes up, but at age 65, CSF pressure falls off the table.
Why?
I don't think that anybody knows. I suspect that the connective tissues of the dura is getting weaker and people are having spontaneous CSF leaks. Maybe they're not making aqueous quite the same. But when you start to think about CSF pressure and aqueous, they're almost identical. Protein concentration is a little different, but the embryology is identical. Diamox lowers eye pressure, lowers CSF pressure. Very similar fluids, the two circulating fluids of the CNS, and they should be in homeostasis. Their pressure should be similar. And when they get out of whack one way or the other, you know, you get glaucoma if eye pressure is higher than CSF. You get papilledema and IIH if CSF is higher than IOP.
That's so, just thinking about it makes a ton of sense, but wow, it's something we were never taught, right?
Right.
Wow, that's just wild. Well,
and us as ophthalmologists, we kind of stopped thinking at maybe the neuro-ophthalmologists don't, but most of us stop thinking at what we can't see anymore. And, you know, it stops.
Anyway, anything behind the optic nerve, I don't think about.
Yeah, right. I'm lucky if I can tell a knee from a shoulder.
Right. Well, even, you know, the more we, you know, get more expertise, we learn more and more about less and less. I mean, now as a resident, you were happy, you know, doing retina stuff, doing PRP, doing diabetic laser. Now, not at all.
Thank God for our fellows because they know so much more than we do because we're so narrow. We're narrow experts.
Yeah. That's for sure. But yeah, getting old is not for wimps. Golly, that's what my dad used to say before he passed away. He's like, getting old is not for wimps.
Mm. How long ago did your dad pass away?
Pretty recent, actually.
I'm sorry, man.
Oh, thank you. He lived a great life. He actually grew up with nothing, and his biggest accomplishment he was so proud of is he has four kids who are doctors in America.
Wow.
That was the biggest deal.
So I heard something. This was from the chair of the ophthalmology department in Colorado. He said, you never really become a man until your dad dies. And my dad's still with us, thankfully, but I don't know if that applies to you, but it rang true to me when he said it.
Yeah, and it's funny. The older we get, the more we become just like our parents. And yeah, that's like a really good thing.
Yeah.
But then, and also some of the lessons really hit home where, you know, my dad, he's his biggest regret his entire life was that he wasted too much of his 50s and 60s working too hard. And for what? Instead of enjoying.
Mm-hmm.
He says, so that when you're on your last breath, you have a little extra change in some digit on a bank. Who cares?
So Uday, you don't know this probably, but you helped me with that a little bit, because as your son was a junior and senior in high school, and if I remember right, maybe bodybuilding.
Yeah, we're big weightlifters. Boom, yeah. Look at the bones.
Yeah, look at that. You kind of took a step back from the scene in ophthalmology, yeah, and said, I'm gonna be a available father during this time with my son. And I think about that. And,
yeah,
and I think I have been with my son and daughter, but it's important.
Yeah, I spent a lot of time when I was in my early 30s, mid-30s, just traveling the world for ophthalmology, doing a ton of travel. But I missed out on just way too much. So I did, from the time my son and daughter were both kind of like maybe early junior high, sixth, seventh grade, until they both graduated high school, I just stopped going to eye meetings. I just, whenever there was an eye meeting instead, we're doing a family trip.
Yeah.
And that turned out to be the best thing ever.
Yeah.
Now both, then they go off to college, then they're gone. Now both my kids are in med school outside of LA. I see them a couple times a year. So I'll never get those years back, which is,
yeah, good.
Even recently I did, I gave a lecture in New Zealand for their RANSCO New Zealand meeting. And in May, and my son had a month off. That was right before he started med school. So he had a month off. And I said, you know what? Father, son, trip, let's do it. We did a month in New Zealand together, just two of us.
I took my son to Australia for an ophthalmology meeting too. And it was a great trip. My wife said he's wearing the same clothes as he did yesterday.
Yeah,
the day after that, she said he's wearing the same clothes as he was the day before and yesterday. Like, it's guy's trip, honey.
Right. That's totally normal. Well, my travel hack is I always take old clothes and then throw them away. And if I need something, I can buy it there.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. Take your Costco socks and underwear and your t-shirts, and just when they get dirty enough, throw them away.
Yeah, good move. I like it.
And you get new ones that remind you of the place. Oh, yeah, I remember I bought this shirt back there in New Zealand. So,
yeah, that's cool, man.
But I think that's important, figuring out that balance there. And I think that's one thing that I did very, very poorly early on, but I'm doing much, much better at now. And I'm taking Pops' advice to heart, where I'm not wasting away my 50s and 60s. Well, my 60s, we'll see. But certainly my 50s, I'm doing a good job of bouncing it out.
Good for you. Well, you're one of the people that helped me not make as big of a mistake as you did early, because you shared the mistake. So thank you for that.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Getting diamond status for the hotel because you stayed there 65 nights last year, actually not a good thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep.
Not a good thing. All right. Tell me one more thing now about, you also started at expertopinionmd.com.
Yeah. Yeah. So the idea behind Expert Opinion originally was to try and say, a patient has a difficult problem, let's connect them with an authentic world's expert.
Sure.
And make it so that it's frictionless or low friction to talk to Uday Devgan or Icomed or whatever with the problem. Or, you know, a single mom in Western North Dakota has a kid that needs a strabismus surgery and they want a second opinion to make sure that it's right. And that's how it started. But we weren't really able to get in front of the patients. And then it pivoted to saying that we have a surgeon that's got a complex case coming up. They're wondering if the technology is right. Should this be an iDose? Should this be a PanOptics? Should this be an IC-8 or whatever the right technology is? But so many of those difficult ones are you know, complex, and a medical science liaison isn't going to really be able to help with. You know, you really need to talk to a surgeon that's done this. And what happens with that one is that, so now when a surgeon needs some help, the company will connect them with the world's expert, and Expert Opinion facilitates that. So you can you can talk to these patients, and talk to these surgeons and help them out. And so it's really slick, and it's one of my favorite things to do, because you're talking to a colleague in their moment of need, and it's, you know, really low friction, and it works pretty good.
So it's also, I guess, then the company that makes the product connects you guys.
That's right. So imagine this. You know, you're a surgeon in Oklahoma, and you say, hey, I got this patient, and they, even let's say they had a PanOptix and it's not going great, or you're wondering if you want to put a PanOptix in, and I'd really like to talk to somebody that's got experience in this situation. Yeah. And they say, the rep says, okay, well, let's see if expert opinion can help. And then they fill out the case, and it goes through medical affairs to make sure it's okay. And then they would connect you with, you pick your three surgeons that you want to talk to, and the first surgeon that replies to a time that works for you connects you, and then you get on a call and you talk through it, and then the records are all uploaded HIPAA compliant, and so you can actually be looking at the physical case while you're talking with the surgeon together.
Oh, this is like Bausch was doing something like this, right? You must be working with them.
So we've got all of the majors, you know, everybody's doing it. And so we've got
the company ends up paying.
The company ends up paying. That's right. So Bausch would pay, or Alcon would pay, or Glaukos would pay to help their customer out in a moment of need, and in a non-promotional way that helps them solve a difficult problem for their patients.
I love it. I like how you pivoted.
Yeah.
That's super, super smart. Yeah, I think that's, one thing I do actually, if I have a mystery case, something happened on the OR, and I just not sure exactly why, I just put the video up on Cataract Coach.
Yeah,
I get 10,000 views in the first week.
Yeah,
and I get tons of comments. Oh, here's what it is. Here's what I think.
Yeah,
that's the amazing part. I can get like a mass appeal to all my viewers, and I get a ton of replies, and I just kind of crowdsource the answer.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. Yeah. Congratulations on Cataract Coach being such a runaway success.
Yeah, it's grown really a tremendous amount, and I still stuck with a new video every day, no matter what. And we're up to almost 2,400 videos.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's coming on seven years or so.
Yeah, I was doing the math in my head, 365 times seven.
that's right. You're a good math guy, math teacher. But no, it's a fun project. And then the podcast, too, is really just taking off.
Yeah, good.
I mean, it's quite, total among all platforms. So with the YouTube, the cataractcoach.com, the Instagram, the Facebook, the LinkedIn, it's more than 1 million views a month.
No way.
Yeah, it's great. It's 30,000 views a day at a minimum.
Wow.
It's just totally bananas. It's crazy.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's like, this is how I get, my son couldn't believe it that I go to these meetings and they're all ophthalmologists want to take selfies with me, especially young ophthalmologists. He's like, they want to take selfies with you? Dad, you're like such a dork. I'm like, yeah, no, but so are they. It's okay. Yeah,
right. We're all right. We already expressed our nerdiness earlier.
Right. Well, that's like the funny thing. I think we did an analysis of our residents when I was teaching residents. I retired from that 2 years ago. But I think over 20-something years, like 40% were high school valedictorian, like you, like me.
it's dorky, right?
Yeah, we're total dorks.
And the, you know, dorky for good.
You know, for sure. For sure. And in a brilliant way. I mean, use all those crazy math skills to, like, how many thousands of surgeons have used astigmatism fix? I think everybody.
Yeah, we get, you know, so that's a very specific use case, but we get about 3,000 a month.
That's a tremendous amount of help.
Yeah.
And saves me from having to figure out the math.
Yeah. Nobody likes to do trig unless you're extra, extra dorky when you don't have to.
Extra good at it. So what do you think is coming down the road here? So you're involved with a lot of companies, a lot of, you kind of got your ear to the ground here. What's coming next for us? So we've seen in the last decade kind of the emergence of MIGS. That's done amazing things for our patients. I'm thinking light splitting, multifocal lenses, trifocal are probably at the limit. I don't know if there can be any, you know, revolutionary changes, probably more slight evolution changes. What's coming down the road?
Let's start with the categories. So let's start with glaucoma. So MIGS, of course, was a huge wave of innovation, and now the angles become the most crowded space in the anatomical body, right? I mean, there's so many things going in there, but I think that my encouragement would be to continue companies do the science well, just because there's a shortcut to get a product to market, make sure you do the science well to help us make decisions, because you'll either come back and bite you on a reimbursement side, or you won't be able to convince surgeons because we've got good options now. So MIGS been a big deal. Drug delivery, big deal. So Durysta came and did better than I thought that it was going to, because it kind of had a restrictive label, but I'm really excited about iDose. I will see if the phase 3 data shows the same thing the phase 2 did, but I think that it's going to last about 3 years. And so you put the iDose in and you got 3 years of prostaglandin that you know the patient is getting, and you're getting it just in the eye, not on the surface. And then, of course, I'm super excited about the goggles for tough-to-treat glaucoma patients, so we can avoid trabs and tubes and treat this, you know, difficult to treat population with normal tension glaucoma and less than 21. By the way, the product's name is Physics FYSX because I'm so dorky.
I love it.
So it's the Physics Ocular Pressure Adjusting Pump. So that's what I think we've got going on that's really exciting on the glaucoma side: drug delivery, new non-invasive ways to do things actually different. Moving to cornea, I think that the most exciting thing that's going on in cornea is the company Orion. They're the ones with the endothelial cell injections. But there's Jeff Goldberg's got a company that's looking at getting endothelial cells going. And then there's this company out of Israel, Ion, that's kind of cool, that is actually, you know, a membrane, an artificial membrane that you put on the back of the cornea, and it just kind of doesn't allow the cornea to hydrate. And the results have been surprisingly good that have been reported. So those are kind of the three things on cornea that I'm excited about. In addition, you know what I'm excited about in cornea too? CTAC, which is customized cross-linked corneal segments instead of intacts that you can put into the cornea in a customized way. We've had some really nice wins for some patients reshaping their cornea normally. And I'm also hopeful that topo-guided treatments continue to improve and get easy enough for us mortals to do it.
Yeah.
Without having to be Mark Lobanoff to treat some of these irregular corneas that had cross-linking in the past. So that's where I'm excited on the cornea side. On the cataract side, I agree with you. I think that diffractive multifocal lenses will have evolutionary improvements, and it's going to change because there's going to be a bunch of trifocals on the market in the next few years.
Yeah,
I also like light adjustability. I don't see accommodating lenses on the horizon. I mean, maybe there are, but if there's something soon, I'm not aware of it. And usually we are. So we'll see, at least 3 years out, but maybe longer. I think that we'll start to combine some adjustability with multifocality or extended depth of focus, or maybe even accommodation, because one of the challenges for accommodative lenses has been hitting refractive targets. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you start to say, okay, let's combine and see if we can't get the best out of these technologies. And so kind of that's maybe, oh, and then I am excited about getting some diagnostics that make the cataract process easier. We've just been adding diagnostic to diagnostic to diagnostic to try and be a virtuoso cataract surgeon. So if we can start to combine some of those things together, I think that can actually make our lives better. On the pharma side, like I said, I'm not a big pharmacologic thinker, but let's see, what am I excited about on the pharma side? It'll be really interesting to see if presbyopia drops can, with Orasys's approval, can get a foothold.
And yeah, the previous versions were okay, but didn't really grab too much market.
No. And so, you know, we'll see if there isn't a market there, or if there is, because I think that the product, you know, probably has the profile to succeed in the marketplace if the marketplace is receptive to it. And so I think that'll be something that I'm paying attention to. 3-4 years ago, presbyopia drops were the hottest thing happening, and then it got pretty quiet pretty quick. And so hopefully that'll be good. That's what I'm excited about.
For me, robotics.
Yeah, you think it's going to be the real deal? Have you played with a robot yet?
Yeah, I'm involved with a company called Horizon Surgical.
Yeah, I'm aware.
I'm blown away.
Yeah.
I'm just blown away. I'm just wow.
I haven't had my hands on it.
So it's basically gonna gonna assist the surgeon in a big way. If you look at like LASIK now, I mean, what percent of it's robotic? I mean, I line the patient up to the femto. The femto does a beautiful flap. What do? I step on a pedal.
Right.
I pivot the bed over to the eczema. Yes, I lift the flap, and you can teach a robot to lift the flap.
Yeah.
Then the eczema tracks the eye 500 times a second, shoots down the ablation, and I put a flap back.
Yeah.
Probably 90% of what I just explained is done by a robot.
Yeah. Well, and femtosecond for cataract surgery. I mean, there's a lot of things that are assisted. I think it's hard for us to look, the same story for every industry, right? Mm-hmm. You're doing assembly line work. You're like, wait a second, that's not going to work. What are we going to do for jobs? ChatGPT, what about English majors? And cataract surgery with a robot, what about us poor eye surgeons? But when I think about what we're trying to do as doctors, it should be a self-defeating job. If we cure glaucoma, we should be happy. If we never have to do a YAG again, we should be happy. Right. We should be happy if there's a way to do cataract surgery better without us. And if not, then we really have to question our nobility as surgeons, because the enemy is the disease. The recipient is the patient. And we're just the ones entrusted to try and find the best solutions for them.
Oh, it makes a ton of sense, of course. Of course. No, but I think even the AI aspect, our group got our first patent this year for AI in relation to IOL calcs.
Yeah.
So we got our U.S. patent here. So that's clearly going to come as well. I think you'll see that more and more in ophthalmology.
Yeah.
We got neat stuff coming, but I don't think we're going to be replaced. On the contrary, the robot can help you with the standard cases, but the real tough cases, that's all you. It'll be tougher. You'll get only the challenging cases.
Yeah, it's kind of like not seeing post-op day ones. I miss them. They're happy.
Oh, that's my favorite day. I'm sad you gave that up.
I am too. Yeah. When I need a better day, then I stop in and say hi to my post-op ones instead of the two fabulous optometrists that I get to work with.
No, I'm very, very lucky. See, all my post-op day one cataract patients, they're just like so thrilled.
Yeah, that's great.
Just, oh, doctor, you're the best. I'm just like just beaming.
Yeah, that's great.
But it's neat stuff. I think what we have come is going to be really, really amazing. I think it's the only challenge is, golly, how much more learning is there? Right. So it's like we continue to learn and learn and learn and learn. It's just like even poor residents, you learn what I learned, plus all the new stuff that was developed in the last 25 years.
Yeah, no, that's true. You know, but and so there is a lot of learning to go. But, you know, I used to think, man, I wonder what it would have been like to be back there in the Renaissance when you could have solved some of the easier problems. Yeah. Right. But then new day, you go back to the conversation we were having about CSF pressure and IOP. That is just a subtraction problem of two pressures. It's super simple. It's not complex to say this pressure differential should matter. And so there's simple solutions out there. We just have to be aware enough to try to connect the dots. And interestingly, one of the reasons why I think that those dots weren't connected earlier was because the units were different. We measure IOP in millimeters of mercury, and CSF is typically measured in centimeters of water.
Oh, so funny. Yeah.
And so we just don't think, you know, we don't do the conversion in our head.
Right, because the units are different.
And isn't it funny that something that, you know, I don't know for sure that that contributed to it, but I got to believe that it did, because how, if your normal IOP is 16 and your normal CSF is say 11 or 12 or something like that, well, then you say, oh geez, if that gets too far away, it should be a problem. But when you say 12, you know, millimeters of mercury is 20 centimeters of water, and you don't
correlate them.
Right.
So I'm sure that had some role. And I'm sure after this podcast, I'm going to have some neuro-ophthalmologist going to say, you know, here's how we increase the CSF pressure.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's some stuff out there that, you know, we know that cause IIH, or at least are idiosyncratically associated with it. Some tricyclic antidepressants, theophylline, caffeine. But like I said, I'm not a very good pharmacologic thinker.
Yeah.
And, you know, messing with CSF pressure just pharmacologically makes me a little bit nervous.
No, for sure. But I think it's brilliant. I think it's gonna kind of open up some new doors here.
Yeah, hope so.
Tell me a little bit about, in our last little bit of time here, tell me about your practice. You got an amazing practice there. You joined Vance Thompson Vision, which is, tell us all about that, because we have also a lot of international listeners who may not know.
Yeah, sounds good. So I'm in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, the home of Vance Thompson. Vance is my senior partner and one of my really just heroes and wonderful friends. And so when I was finishing up fellowship, trying to figure where I wanted to go, I wasn't sure that I wanted to come back home to Sioux Falls. And Vance and my grandma, who is my hero, was one of Vance's important mentors for faith in his and his wife's life. Vance took a selfie with my grandma at church and said, "Your grandma wants you to do her cataract surgery, won't travel more than 70 miles. Looks like you're joining me." And so I did. And it was just one of the best decisions ever. We were in a health system at the time. We broke away, created our own place. Vance was kind of on his own primarily, and had already developed a reputation and a brand in our region, and founded Vance Thompson Vision and did just a great job with that. And then we together it was kind of a nice fit, and it accelerated things. And we he had done a lot of clinical trials. Now we were adding glaucoma and maybe more cataract and things to the clinical trial portfolio. But the biggest thing was we started a fellowship. And if you ask my wife, Uday, she would say, if there's one word that encapsulates you, John, it's teacher. You just can't not do it.
Mm-hmm.
And, today, I couldn't just wait to talk about CSF pressure and try to make it make sense. Sure. I can't not do it. So 11 years ago, we started a fellowship, and my goal was for it to be the best fellowship in the country, or if not one of the top. Mm-hmm. And it's my favorite professional thing.
Wow.
It's number one. To have somebody that's at the pinnacle of 30 years of education that you get to spend one-on-one teaching clinical skills, surgical skills, fine, but also how to be a better human. And what it really means to do the right thing. And what separates you is probably not how smart you are, it's how much you care and how much you're willing to do when something's hard. And I love it. And we didn't ever have any plan to expand beyond Sioux Falls. But then Mike Greenwood, our second fellow, said, "Hey, I want to be a part of this and I want to go back to North Dakota." And so, all right, we don't know what we're doing. Let's see how it goes. And we did. And so now we're in Omaha, Sioux City, Sioux Falls, Fargo, Alexandria, Billings, and Bozeman, Montana. And about half of our surgeons or so were fellows with us, and the other half weren't. And man, I love Mondays, dude. I love coming to work. I love the energy of our people. Our team is the secret sauce. I didn't really believe that necessarily when I joined. I thought it was going to be about me, and I can't wait for people to call and tell me how great I am. And what they call and they say, "I love how you answer your phones. Your phone team is the best." And then we try to provide a good experience for people and actually care.
Yeah, that's what, when I had Vance on the podcast many, many moons ago, he talked a lot about the patient experience. Tell me about that.
Yeah. So, I'll start with the typical example and how I remember this very vividly. I was going to our local health system, My son was sick. My wife and I were there. He wasn't bad sick. He was just sick. You know, we're going to go get something checked out. You walk in and there's a sign here that says, if your kid's really sick, go in this room. Like I'm ever going to walk into that room with my kid. And then you walk out to the front desk and there's two crinkled pieces of paper with some coffee stains and some scotch tape on them. And the first one says, if this light is blinking, I'm on the phone. Please be courteous and I'll be with you in a moment. And there's a little hand-drawn arrow to the blinking light.
Okay.
The next one says, please be courteous to our staff and other patients and refrain from using your cell phone in the waiting room. So now I haven't even talked to a human yet, but I've been told I have to figure out if I'm allowed to talk to somebody. And while you're making me wait, I'm the rude one if I'm on my cell phone. And by the way, the sign next to that said your copay is due before anybody will talk to you or something along those lines. And we're supposed to be caring.
Yeah.
That's what medicine is supposed to be. It's supposed to be, hey, we know life's coming at you hard. We're here for you. And it's almost the opposite of that. Never mind, you can never figure out what the bill means.
Yeah.
And so when we built the practice and as we try to flow it, we try to do things that are just every step of the way be intentional. The parking lot stripes are white, not yellow. Yellow says caution. White doesn't say caution. Anywhere we don't have to have a curb where we park, doesn't have a curb that you don't have to paint, that somebody couldn't trip on and they can, you know, walk up. When they check in at the front desk, it should feel like we're happy that you showed up because we actually are. It shouldn't feel like, oh, I was hoping you weren't going to come because that's the only way we can get back on schedule today.
Right.
And then when they check in, they sit down in a specific area. The team gets a thing in the back that says Uday's in the black shirt in section F1. And then they come up to you and they say, hey, Uday, I'm happy you're here for your cataract eval with Dr. Thompson. You're going to really like him. Come on back. Let's get you started. As opposed to standing from there and yelling, Uday?
Right. Wait, where are you? Yeah.
And so every step of the way, we try to make sure that people feel like we actually care because we actually do.
Mm-hmm. That makes a huge, huge, huge difference. And also, I see you separated the phones from the front desk.
Right. I mean, that poor lady at the pediatrician's office, how can she like her day? It's just, who am I going to make unhappy next? The person on the phone or the person standing in front of me?
Yeah, it's tough to do both. Separating them makes it much easier.
Yeah, and so anyway, we don't do it perfect. We're good at hiding our warts, but we do it. We are purposeful about it, and we try to do it really well. My favorite thing is that any employee can give any other employee or any patient an up to $100 gift card for any reason.
Cool. Sounds great.
And it's never been abused. It's been somebody lost their wife and we sent them flowers.
Mm-hmm.
It's somebody's having a baby and we sent them cookies. It's we made somebody wait and we bought them gas for their drive home or bought them lunch. And so sometimes it's recovering service. Sometimes it's touching them. My favorite one was a little old lady that I was doing cataract surgery on. And I said, how's your vision? She said, well, it's getting worse. I can't see the score on the Twins game. I said, are you a Twins fan? She says, oh, I'm a huge Twins fan. I never miss a game on TV. I said, Twins are about 4 hours away in Minneapolis. And I said, well, how many games have you been to? She's like, I've never been to a game. It's on my bucket list.
Oh, wow.
So we came out and my technician looks at me and I didn't have to say anything. She said, we're getting her Twins tickets, aren't we? Mm-hmm. So So the day after her cataract surgery, we gave her twins tickets. My team gave them to her. I didn't give them to her. She goes and watches the Minnesota Twins with her new vision for the first time in her life. She calls back to the phone team. She's crying about how happy she is, how she sees, but that she hasn't felt cared for like that, like in decades.
Yeah. I get that. Yeah. Cool. Yeah, just to know that people actually care.
Yeah.
That's an important one. Yeah. Especially now in our modern world where, you know, people say there's like a loneliness epidemic, right?
Yeah. Well,
more isolated and
yeah, my grandma stole this from somebody, but she taught me that people don't care what you know until they know that you care.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I've heard that too. Johnny Gayton taught me that one. Yeah. On the podcast. I love him.
Yeah,
he's basically giving the treatment you want to receive. We all learned that in kindergarten, right? The golden rule.
Yeah. Yeah. And being a doctor, there's some parts of it that are difficult, but it really comes down to one question: is if it was me or if it was my mom or my son, what would I want if it was my eye? Do that. That's it.
That's an easy way of thinking. I love it. I did the same thing. I had a patient asking me like all these questions. Well, and this type of surgery, what would you do for this? I said, I will give you the exact surgery every step of the way that I'd want from my own eyes.
Yeah.
I mean, that means the best of the best of the best, everything.
Yeah.
And then they're like, oh, okay. Then they were like, they just relaxed.
Yeah. Yep. And if doctors lose trust, if we as a profession lose trust, it's done. We have to do the right thing because it's the right thing. That you can end there. But man, if we lose trust, we're going to make mistakes. But if we lose trust, oh man, we're going to be in a bad spot.
Yeah, luckily, I think we're going to be good with that. I think we're a generation of doctors, that's for sure.
What I worry about is that we advocate our decision making to somebody that didn't take an oath. And so we need to make sure that we stand up for those patients and be part of it, not simply say, I don't want anything to do with anything else except for just taking care of that patient, because there's so much more to healthcare than that, that if we advocate our authority and our moral high ground, I worry that we will end up in a worse spot.
Yeah, I think it's important to have physicians still in charge of the leadership of the health organizations, the business of the health organizations as well, not just the direct patient care.
That's right. I agree.
I think if we do that, I think the next generation really gets this. I think I've been super impressed by the younger, the ophthalmologists who have no gray hair, unlike us.
Yeah, no kidding. So, you know, fellowship interview day is coming up for us here soon. It's two of my favorite days of the year, 2 days of interviews. I am so inspired by these young people. I mean, I am not a, boy, the next generation sucks, get off my grass guy. I think that they, every time, now to be fair, we're getting a pretty, it's pretty rarefied air.
Right, right.
Man, they're amazing. Oh my goodness.
How many fellows do you take a year?
One.
What, and you must have 30 interviews.
We do 12 interviews. We get about...
How many applicants do you get for the fellowship?
60 to 70, but that's about the total number of applicants there are. We're under a cornea, but it's really anterior segment. They get to do... they end up with about 2,400, 2,500 primary surgeries.
In a year?
In a year.
That's got to be like the top fellowship number, period.
Yeah, so they get to do a lot. You know, DMX, PKPs, MIGs, glaucoma surgery, refractive cataracts, sutured IOLs.
Are the 12 people you interview, they're all amazing. You start with 70, you choose 12 to interview, and you choose one fellow. How?
Yeah, so great question. So for the people that are applying for fellowship, here's a little bit of the answer key. The first, what I look at is I look at research projects and did they finish them? Because I want a finisher. Okay. So if you have four projects that are about done or manuscript in preparation, that's almost a negative, unless you've already published a bunch of stuff. So I look at finishers. I look at rec letters from people that I know and trust. And what did they say? And did they say they were one of the best ever or in the top 5%, maybe top 10%? I look at the personal statement. A lot of people don't, but I love the personal statement. That's your chance to tell me who you are. And if you're like, and if you start your personal statement with, I remember the first time I saw a corneal ulcer. Yeah. Oh, see you later. How boring. And so those are a couple of the key pieces. And then, but of the 70, we probably get maybe 20 that are have separated themselves for an interview, and only 12 get it. And you know, it's those borderlines that are tough. But of those 12, there's usually about 4 or 6. I'll say this year's a awfully good application group. There's usually about 4 or 6 that have separated themselves even in their application.
Mm.
And then it's on interview day, it's those kind of 4 or 6 that are vying. Although once in a while you get a dark horse that gets in there and a couple of people drop out. But the final thing is that I call up people and that have worked side by side with them in the trenches and find out if they're legit. That's the most valuable thing at the end.
Yeah, I totally agree. For me, like when we were looking at how to choose residents, it was all about work ethic.
Yeah.
Right? If you look back, your best residents are the ones who, yeah, of course, they cared, they're smart. But by definition, they're all smart. But who has the killer work ethic? I think that's the differentiator.
That's right. Yeah, I like a worker too. We're Midwestern work ethic up here.
Yeah, my level of crazy is who else can I ask? Make a new video every day for 2,300 days in a row. That takes a special level of crazy.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, it does. You got it. You got it, man.
So it's but it's been fun. Well, I love talking to you, John. This is so much fun.
Yeah.
Can't wait to actually need to come visit your place one day. Gotta see where the magic happens at Vance Thompson Vision.
Come see us, Uday. I can't wait. We'll give you some South Dakota hospitality.
I would love, and some good game meat.
Yeah, we got it. We can have some chislik. We can. Oh yeah, we're in.
Venice backstrap. Sign me up.
Oh, yeah, giddy up.
All right, thank you so much. I want to remind our listeners and viewers. Remember, we got a new podcast every single week. We are the top podcast in all of ophthalmology, and of course, there's still a new cataract coach video every single day. You find our podcast on Apple, Amazon, Google, Spotify, anywhere you find your podcasts, and we will catch you next time.